Pancho felt the jets and scrubbers pummeling her brutally. "Hey, Doug," she gasped, "you gotta reset these things to go easier." His voice in her helmet earphones sounded bemused. "We did reset them, Pancho. They would have knocked you flat if we'd left them at the same power level we used for the hard shell suits." It took Pancho a few moments to catch her breath once she had stepped out of the car wash and onto the factory floor. As Stavanger came up beside her, also breathing heavily, she looked out at the two completed spacecraft. Their diamond hulls looked dark, like ominous shadows lurking beneath the curved roof of the factory. "There they are," Stavanger said tightly. "One for you, and one for Humphreys." She understood the tension in his voice. "Two brand new warships, so we can go out and kill some more mercenaries." Stavanger said nothing. "We've got six more under contract, right?" she asked. After several heartbeats, Stavanger said, "Yes, and we're building the same number for Humphreys. So no matter who wins, Cellini makes money." "I don't like it, Pancho. I don't like any of this. If I could convince the Governing Council to renege on these contracts, I would." "I don't like it either, Doug. But what else can we do? Let the Humper take over the whole dang solar system?" He fell silent again. As they trudged back in silence toward the airlock at Cellini, Pancho said to herself, "Deadlock. Cellini doesn't want either one of us to win. They don't want one side to beat the other, become the master of the whole solar system. Even if Astro wins, if I win, Cellini's scared shitless that they might be under my thumb. Doug wants to see Humphreys and Astro fight ourselves into exhaustion, and then he'll step in and be the peacemaker again. So they're doing their best to keep us even. They won't make a warship for Humphreys without making one for Astro. Keeps them neutral, Doug says. Keeps us in a deadlock. That's what it keeps. There's got to be some way out of this. Some way to break through and beat the Humper before we're both so broke and dead flat exhausted that both our corporations go bust. If I could get Lars to help us, she thought, he might just be able to tip the scales in our favor. But the little bugger has disappeared. What's he up to? Why has he gone to ground on me? Shaking her head inside the fishbowl helmet, Pancho considered, we need an outside force, a partner, an ally. Somebody who can tip the scales in Astro's favor, outmaneuver Humphreys, overpower him. Some way to outflank HSS. Then it hit her. Nairobi! That guy from Nairobi Industries wanted a strategic alliance with Astro. I wonder if he's still interested. I'll have to look him up soon as I get back to the office. Whatever his name was.
Astro Corporation Command Center. Jake Wanamaker's Command Center was a cluster of offices set slightly apart from the rest of Astro Corporation's headquarters. With wry humor, Wanamaker mused that Humphreys could do more damage to Astro at far less cost by attacking these offices and wiping out the corporation's military command. But even war has its rules, and one of the fundamental rules of this conflict was that no violence would be tolerated anywhere on the moon. The side that broke that rule would bring Cellini and its considerable financial and manufacturing clout into the battle as an enemy. So despite the purely perfunctory guards stationed at the double doors of the command center, armed with nothing more than sidearms, Wanamaker had little fear of being attacked here in Cellini. He went through the doors and down the central corridor, heading for his own office, to a chorus of "Good morning, Admiral," accompanied by military salutes. Wanamaker returned each salute scrupulously. Good discipline began with mutual respect, he felt. Wanamaker's office was Spartan. The battleship gray metal furniture was strictly utilitarian. The only decorations on the walls were citations he had garnered over his years of service. The wall screens were blank as his staff filed in and took their chairs along the scuffed old conference table that butted against his desk. Wanamaker had salvaged them both from his last Sea Command, an amphibious assault command vessel. He spent the morning outlining Pancho's idea of setting up a blockade against incoming HSS ore carriers. Unmanned craft? Asked one of his junior officers. Uncrewed, Wanamaker corrected. Remotely operated from here. One of the women officers asked, Here in Selene? Won't that get Stavanger and the Governing Council riled up? Not if we don't commit any violent acts here in Selene, Wanamaker replied, smiling coldly. Then he added, And especially if they don't know about it. It won't be easy to build and launch the little robots without Stavanger's people finding out about it. We can build them easily enough in Astro's factories up on the surface and launch them aboard Astro boosters. No need for Selene to get worked up over this. The younger officers glanced at each other up and down the conference table while Wanamaker watched from behind his desk. They get the idea, he saw. I'm not asking for their opinions about the idea. I'm telling them that they've got to make it work. Well, his engineering chief said, we can build the little suckers easily enough. Nothing exotic about putting together a heavy laser with a communication system and some station-keeping gear. Good, said Wanamaker. Gradually, the rest of the staff warmed to the idea. At length, he asked, how long will it take? We could have the first ones ready to launch in a couple of weeks, said the engineer. Wanamaker silently doubled the estimate. Wait, cautioned the intelligence officer, a plump Armenian with long, straight dark hair and darker eyes. Each of these birds will need sensors to identify potential targets and aim the lasers. No worries, said the Australian electronics officer. We can do that in 2 shakes of a sheep's tail. Piece of cake. Besides, pointed out the engineer, the birds will be operated from here, with human brains in the loop. The intelligence officer looked dubious, but voiced no further objections. All right, then, said Wanamaker at last. Let's get to work on this. Pronto. Time is of the essence. That broke up the meeting. But as the staff officers were shuffling toward the door, Wanamaker called the intelligence officer back to his desk. Sit down, Willie, he said, gesturing to the chair on the desk's left side. He knew she disliked to be called by her real name, Wilhelmina. The things parents do to their kids, Wanamaker thought. She sat, looking curious, almost worried. Wanamaker took a breath, then said, We need a diversion. Sir, Humphreys has beat the hell out of us in the belt, and it's going to be months before we can start fighting back. But Jess said he'd have the first robots on station in 2 weeks, the intelligence officer countered. 2 weeks plus Murphy's Law, Wanamaker said. Her dark eyes lit with understanding. If anything can go wrong, it will. Especially in a wartime situation. I know the staff will push as hard as they can, but I don't expect to be able to hit back to HSS with these robot systems for at least a month, maybe more. I see, she said. Meanwhile, we need a diversion. Something to knock the HSS people off their feet a little, shake them up, make them realize we're not going to lay down and die. Such as? He grinned lopsidedly at her. Well, that's what I want you to figure out, kid. She did not smile back. I'll do my best, sir.
Asteroid 73-241. Levinson felt distinctly uneasy in the spacesuit. It was bad enough to have to fly out to this remote piece of rock in the middle of nowhere, carrying the heavily armored flask of nanomachines he had produced in the HSS lab at Selene. Now he had to actually go out of the ship like some super jock astronaut and supervise the crew he had brought with him. Me? He had asked, alarmed, when Vicky Farrar told him that Martin Humphreys himself wanted Lev to personally supervise the experiment. You, she had replied, silky smooth, it's to your advantage to handle the job yourself. Why let someone else take the credit for it? As he hung weightlessly between the slowly spinning torch ship and the lumpy dark asteroid, clipped to the tether that was anchored to the ship's airlock, Lev realized that Vicky had played him like a puppet. Her alluring smiles and promising cleavage, her smoky voice and tantalizing hints of what would be possible after he had succeeded with his nanomachines, had brought him out here, to this dark and cold emptiness, face to face with a pitted, ugly chunk of rock the size of a football field. Well, he told himself,